This is your Dog City Radio.
I can't hear anything, man.
I can hear you. I can hear you.
Yeah, that's because you go live when the sound stops, so you can't hear anything. That means the sound has stopped.
Okay, and as soon as we started, before I even realised, welcome to Dark City Radio. We've got another Jenga issue today that we're going to be discussing today. We've got special guests. We've got Janet, and we've also got Sarah Lioness as well, who's come to talk in, and Bob and Jabba and Sparky. Jenga is a grassroots organisation which highlights how joint enterprise is being misused today by the court systems and the police. It is when you are guilty purely by association, and this association can just be that you're drinking in the same pub as somebody, or I've heard stories that you can hire a car and then somebody else hires it afterwards and therefore there's an association. There's lots of really big cases here where it's been totally misused. And the reason why I got into this in the first place is because my friend has been charged under joint enterprise, and he's serving 15 years in prison now for a murder which he didn't commit. And he's actually a really nice bloke and has never harmed anyone and does nothing but good, really. And apparently this is what often happens to nicer people. And this seems to affect mainly people who haven't got a lot of money, so they can't afford good legal representation, and so this makes it more prone to people who haven't got, you know, who are poorer people. And it's a really important issue to be highlighted. Okay, so why did you get involved with Jenga, Janet, please?
It was when my son was convicted of murder in 2008. I realised something had gone wrong because he was innocent. He didn't commit any murder, and the trial process kind of proved that he wasn't guilty of murder, but he was proven innocent, if you like, but found guilty of murder because the way that the joint enterprise principle is applied, you can prove that you didn't commit the murder, but that's not necessarily what the courts want you to prove. They want you to prove things like that you didn't have foresight, or it's almost like you didn't have a premonition, you know, as if you could be telepathic and know that someone would commit a crime even before the person who commits the crime commits it. So I didn't have any idea that was going on in the courts. And obviously when my son went to court, we went there to prove that he hadn't committed a murder. And we were quite successful in proving that Jordan didn't murder anyone. But we weren't very good at proving that he wasn't a joint enterprise because we didn't understand the process. So after he was convicted, I was convinced that it was just our case and that it was just us, that it had gone horribly wrong. And I tried to do some research and I couldn't find anything about joint enterprise. And the more I looked, the more people I came into contact with who it had also happened to. And it became really clear to me that, you know, we needed a campaign here, not just for Jordan, but for other people who the same thing had happened to, not just to help them get out of the situation that they were in, but to prevent other people from going to prison for crimes that they hadn't committed.
Yeah, to me it seems like it's turned the law a bit on its head, because it's normally innocent, well, it's meant to be innocent until proven guilty, but with joint enterprise, it seems to be the opposite way around.
Well, yeah, because I think everybody is under the impression that you are innocent until proven guilty. And that's a theory that's been going on for hundreds of years. It's called backfiction, and it means it's better for 10 guilty men to go free than for one innocent person to be convicted. And you know, I think most normal people, most rational people would agree with that, because the horror of being put in prison for the rest of your life, if you're innocent, it far outweighs, you know, the guilty walking free, because of course the guilty walking free, they can be caught again, can't they? You know, rather than put the innocent man in prison, it's much better to search for the guilty one. But joint enterprise, you're actually guilty and you have to prove you're innocent, which is much more difficult, because this particular law doesn't really use any high level of evidence. It runs on assumptions and speculation and hearsay evidence. And it's very difficult to put forward physical evidence to counteract that. However, if you were to put that kind of evidence forward, it wouldn't be admissible. It would be classed as very weak evidence, and the courts wouldn't want to hear that from you. So you're exactly right. It's turned the whole innocent unproven to proven guilty on its head. So you're now guilty beforehand, and the media goes a long way with securing that theory.
Hello.
As well.
Because... Yeah, the media in my friend's case made him sound like he was a really horrible person, and the other two that were convicted as well.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
and it's just not true. It's just they were demonized.
Yeah, the newspapers will vilify you from the very beginning and actually call you a murderer and set the story beforehand. And obviously, members of the jury are going to be reading these stories before the trial date's even set. Of course, the judge will tell you to forget everything you've read before you hear the case, but that's all too late. Once the story's out there, regardless of whether it's the truth or not, people can't forget it.
No, not at all. Was there something you wanted to say, Sarah? Because you've put a lot of text in the box. Did you want to say something about what we said so far?
No, not really. I'm just looking up. I'm researching this as I'm hearing you talk. It appears to be very sort of the health and safety laws, where everyone is responsible for everyone else and everyone else is liable. It completely flies in the face of the rule of law. It's taken me by surprise. I'm researching, so please carry on talking. I'm researching while I'm listening.
Okay, thank you. That's great that you're on our side looking at things and researching with your illegal mind. So thank you. So your son, how old was he when this happened to him? He was only 14 or something.
He was 15 years old when he was charged with murder. Yeah. He'd actually been coming home from the Chippy one night, walking down the street with a group of friends, and quite a lot of friends, perhaps about 15 boys, girls, when someone came out, a man came out and chased them up the street, and he'd sort of mistaken them for being vandals to a mini digger to the house next door but one, when in fact the people who damaged the mini digger had already run away. So he accosted the wrong people. It became quite violent, and in a matter of a few seconds, one of the boys who was a friend of my son's kicked this man, and unfortunately that one kick was what killed him. My son didn't take any part in any argument or any confrontation, let alone any physical assault on the victim. And he was a very poor witness for the prosecution as well, because from the very start it was clear that Jordan hadn't witnessed it, but that was because he has an eye condition, which meant that at the time he should have been considered as registered blind, so he didn't see any of the attack. And this is the thing that gets me the most angry, that he's supposed to have witnessed it and done nothing to prevent it. But that would have been impossible, because when you can't see, you can't see what's going on, and it wouldn't be possible to prevent it.
No, it wouldn't at all. So what is the aim of JENGBA as an organisation?
I think the main thing is to get people to understand what this legal principle is all about, so that they understand that the evidence being used against people to convict them for very serious crimes is very weak evidence. It's not forensic. It's not scientific. It's none of those things. It's more about speculation and circumstantial evidence. And like you said earlier, association. If you are a friend of the person who commits the crime, or if you receive a phone call from the person who commits the crime, then that's the tenuous evidence that's used as association and used to then convict you of the actual murder itself. And people are getting, life sentences for this. So it's very serious. But one of our aims is to get people to understand just how, high-level evidence is being used at the moment to convict people to life sentences, and to also get them to support us in getting Parliament to either put this law into legislation, but legislation that means the evidence that's used becomes strong evidence rather than speculation and hearsay. As it would be in a normal murder trial where it was one person who was charged with murder, the evidence would have to be very strong in order to convict them. And we want that to be used all across the board, not just in a single person on a murder charge, but if you're trying to convict people of murder in multiples, then either charge them for the crime that they've committed, and begin to use strong evidence to do that so that the right person goes to prison and the innocent don't.
Yeah, these are really long prison sentences as well. Like my friend got 15 years, but there's people getting 30 years, 35 years for just receiving a phone call after a murder which they never even knew was going to happen and didn't even know had happened. You know, this is what makes this so terrible, is that you don't even have to be there. You don't even have to know a murder's going to be happening. You don't even have to know that a murder has been committed. And you can end up in prison for 35 years because somebody phoned you afterwards.
And I think as well when people get convicted of a telephone call, the prosecution don't have to divulge what the conversation was on the telephone. They just make an assumption that what the telephone conversation was about. It isn't recorded, so they're not showing the jury that this is the actual conversation. And that's another frightening element, because it's all down to the prosecution's imagination as to this is what we think the conversation was about. But because prosecutors are trusted to be people who are supposed to be telling the truth and people who are supposed to be fighting for justice, juries are going to believe somehow that, you know, this man's right. He wouldn't say this if he didn't know what he was talking about. But the truth is, prosecutors aren't actually telling you exactly what was being said in these conversations, because they don't know. Because how can they know if they haven't recorded the conversation anyway and they weren't there listening to it themselves? So it's just based on speculation. So anyone who goes to prison because of a phone call will be going to prison because of what the prosecutor believes may have been said on that telephone call, not because they actually do know what was said.
Most people who I talk to about this find it totally unbelievable that this, and I've even been asked, what country is this that this is happening in? And when I reply, this one, Britain, England, this is where it's happening. This is where it's happening to people, quite a lot of people, in fact, you know, and they just can't believe it, that it would actually happen here. It's just unbelievable, really.
I get people saying to me that they wouldn't believe it if it was happening in a third world country, because it just seems so medieval and so wrong and so against anything that we would assume would be the law or would be justice. So that's one of our main problems, is fighting that concept that this can't possibly be happening in 21st century Britain, but it is. And I think the police and the CPS and the prosecutors and the courts have got away with it for so long because people can't believe it's happening. It just doesn't sound as if this is British justice, because everyone says British justice is the best in the world. But as long as we're using this principle, this legal principle, to convict innocent people, then we can't say that British justice is the best in the world, because we're putting too many people in prison who haven't committed a crime.
Yeah, this is just being totally abused, really, isn't it, and misused. And I read that article you did in The Guardian, and I can't remember his name, but he had to admit that it sounds like abused, and it is being abused. You know, people are using it, like maybe police are using it to get brownie points, to get promotion, to move on in their jobs. I don't understand really why this is actually happening. I just can't work out the mentality of how people can put young kids and older people, of people of all ages, to prison for nothing. Nice, kind, gentle people that haven't done anything to anyone, who just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I think the most horrific thing as well is that the sentences that people who are convicted of joint enterprise receive are far greater than the normal minimum sentences that your average one-on-one murderer or rapist or paedophile would get. It seems that a man who murders a child would get less time in prison, you know, for torturing and murdering a small child, a defenceless child, than someone who was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time when an incident occurs that they had nothing to do with. Because we've got people going to prison for 35 years to life who didn't lay a finger on the victim and had no idea it was going to happen. And yet you can have a man or a woman who murders a child who may torture them over months and neglect them and murder them, who probably go to prison for as least a time as 5 or 6 years. And I find that horrendous, that, you know, that we can treat the real criminals and the real cruel people and the real dangerous people with much more lenient prison sentences than we can people who haven't actually committed the crime itself.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable, really, isn't it? It beggars for belief, really. I don't understand it either. And one of the things is as well that happens with people that are on, that get done under joint enterprise, is because they are innocent and because they're innocent of any crime, they go through the whole case, court case, saying they're innocent, and they plead not guilty. And because they plead not guilty, they end up with a longer prison sentence.
And the fact that when they maintain innocence in prison, that goes against them. But you know, when it comes to the point where when they're ready for release, when they have actually done the minimum term, the authorities look at them as someone who hasn't progressed, who hasn't been rehabilitated, still have come to terms with what the crime that they've committed. But of course, if you haven't committed that crime, how can you be rehabilitated for something you haven't done? And why would anyone who hasn't killed someone say that they have, when they haven't? And the other thing, the other tangent to it as well, is the courts know you haven't actually, you know, inflicted the fatal wound, and you're not the actual murderer. For you to then sort of goes against how you were convicted in the first place anyway. So you're in a catch-22. There's no way out. Whatever you say, you know, you can't get out of it.
What would you recommend to anyone who found themselves up in the police station being charged with this joint enterprise now? What would you recommend that they did?
I'd recommend that they didn't say a word. I mean, I know that sounds awful, but just no comment. No comment until you'd sought the right legal advice and you had decent legal representation. Because, you know, when the police say anything you do say may be taken down and used against you. It is used against you, however minor and however helpful you're trying to be, it will be used against you. You hear about people complaining that that, you know, in a sort of gang or a group, there's a war of silence. And I think this has led to that wall of silence, because what's happening now is, if something happens and you're a witness to it, many people that we have who we're supporting have gone to the police station and said, we were there, we saw what happened, we want to help. And they've tried to give evidence so that they can be there for the prosecution, so that they can help solve the crime and they can tell the truth, and that justice can be served. And they've actually found themselves being arrested, being charged with murder, and then receiving a life sentence in prison. So it even turns against people who are trying to do the right thing, because when someone tries to do the right thing, they very often find themselves in the dock with the other defendants and on trial for murder as well. So, you know, when anyone complains about this wall of silence, when a violent act occurs and someone is killed, the reason for that is because people are too afraid to tell the truth, because by telling the truth, they can find themselves being convicted of murder themselves.
I can't actually think of any benefits to this joint enterprise. The more I hear about it, the more I realise how terrible it actually is, you know, because you want to encourage people to talk about a murder or a crime that's being committed. I know if I had a family or friends that had been murdered, I'd want people to say if they've seen it. But this is just encouraging.
At the same time, you have to protect yourself, because you too could end up doing a life sentence just by trying to help the police.
Yeah, exactly. Hearing all this, it makes you think, well, I wouldn't say anything then. I just wouldn't say a thing. I wouldn't report it. I wouldn't help in any way whatsoever. Because there has been actual cases of people that have helped have ended up with longer prison sentences than the people who have actually committed the crime. If you have a look on the Joint Enterprise website, there's a lot of case studies on there to back up what we're saying. The site is www.jointenterprise.co.uk. Is it .uk, isn't it? Take a look on there, and that'll give you a lot of information and a lot more information and references about the cases and everything. And so you can then start carrying out your own research into this, because I think everyone needs to know about this. You know, everyone needs to know, because it can happen to literally anybody. And I do know that, because it's happened to my friend. And it's happened to your son, hasn't it? And Hang on, we'll bring her back in.
Welcome to voicemail. The person you have called is on the phone.
Hello, are you back? She had to put the phone down. Yeah, but this is something that really does need highlighting. You know, it seems to be something that is totally misused within our court systems.
Hello.
Hello, you're right.
I lost you then, it went off.
Yeah.
All right.
Really bad luck. Oh,
can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, it breaks up, I can hardly hear you.
Yeah, can you hear me now better? Yeah, Sarah, oh, I think you need to mute as well.
It's the telephone, Sarah, at the guest end, unfortunately.
Yeah. It'd be better on Skype, but it's okay. We can hear you we can hear you when you're talking. It's been okay.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it just goes crackly every now and again, but we can hear you the most of the time.
Oh, good, good. I can hear you, and then it starts breaking up, and I don't know whether you've stopped talking or not, and whether I'm interrupting with you.
Okay, Sarah.
Yeah, me. Hello.
Hear you loud and clear. Yep.
Hi, I'd just like to ask, just out of curiosity, do you know the percentage of people that are accused under this joint enterprise law that are not legally represented?
We've tried to get statistics, because we had a Justice Select Committee inquiry, and we've asked the CPS for statistics on, you know, how many joint enterprise cases there are, how many convictions. We've asked numerous questions, but apparently when it comes to joint enterprise, there are no statistics at all in place. So none of the questions that we asked, there are answers to, because they don't keep statistics.
That's interesting. Have you tried with the Freedom of Information request?
Yes, and we hit a brick wall. I find it really hard to believe that there are no statistics. I think it's preferable that they don't release statistics, because it would, you know, it would probably open another can of worms in the whole thing. But, you know, they say there are none, so we have to assume that they're telling the truth. But I do think if we could get the statistics, and we could find how many people, and, you know, the verdicts being reached, and how, you know, and who's saying that they're innocent and who's not, then we'd have a lot more people, and we'd know a lot more than the research that we've actually done at the moment.
What does your research tell you? What the cases that you've looked at, do you know if they've been represented? Hello?
Hello, sorry.
Could you hear me? She came again.
Are you still there, Janet?
Yes, I'm still here.
Hi, Janet, can you hear me?
I can now, yes.
I'm saying, of the cases that you have carried out for Jengba, do you know how many of those have been legally represented?
The ones that have been legally represented through the trial process, yeah.
Yeah, they have.
I think so. I think I know of one person, of one of our cases who had to represent himself, but just one person I know of. I think his name's Roger Kahn. I think he had to represent himself throughout his trial, and he even went to the Court of Appeal and represented himself there as well. But he's just the one person that I know of out of the 400 that we support. Mainly, most people who are represented begin the representation by having the duty solicitor at the beginning of the questioning from the police station.
Yeah, most of those people generally get found guilty too.
Yes. Yes,
for most
that was the case with my son. We used the duty solicitor because he was the first person that we spoke to, and we went to trial within 3 months of the trial. So to us, it felt like the only option was to retain him, because there just wasn't enough time to find anyone else.
And are you aware of any outcomes at appeal? Have any appeals been successful?
Most people, when they appeal, I mean, in our case, when we tried to appeal, it was kind of thrown out straight away. The theory is that when you go back to the Court of Appeal, you have to take strong evidence. But because there's not the evidence used during the trial, there is no strong evidence in the first place. It's virtually impossible to then go back to the Court of Appeal with strong evidence to prove that you're innocent.
Yeah, I've always used the appeal process to make the other side provide their evidence. And of course, it seems in these cases that there isn't any. I wonder if that would be a better tack, you know, better way.
That sounds like a really good idea, actually, yeah. Yeah,
well, that's
because awesome. I know my son wants to know exactly what the reason why he was found guilty, but no one's been able to tell him.
Yeah, this is something that I bang on about, and I'm sorry, I sound like a broken record to anyone who's heard me talk before, but there's a procedure called disclosure. You create a disclosure order, and you make the court make the other party disclose the evidence against you, because if there isn't.
Yeah, I know there are a lot of cases where the police won't release the disclosure evidence as well, and people who seem to take years and years trying to get disclosure evidence, and again fighting against a brick wall because the police won't reveal or release the information that people are asking for.
But if you do a disclosure order, you make the court order the police to disclose rather than you asking the police, because quite often the police don't seem to be obliged to do it. But with a court order, they must do, or then they lose the appeal, or rather your appeal is upheld.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
this just sounds appalling. I'm blown away by this.
Most people are when they hear about it.
Yeah,
I was. I know for sure. The only reason why I found out about it is like I said, because of my friend. And he was, when he got arrested, he didn't know what to do. He didn't have a clue what to do. You know, he didn't know anything about the law. You know, and he'd been drinking quite heavily for quite a while. So he was all in a bit of a daze with everything. He wasn't, you know, he's suffering from withdrawals of things, and you know, he wasn't in the right frame of mind, and he wasn't in the best of space, and he didn't have a clue, so he wasn't clear thinking or anything, you know. So he ended up the same as Jordan with a duty solicitor, and next thing he knows, he's in prison for 15 years, and he didn't think that this was going to happen to him. You know, the whole way through, he still never thought that he was going to be found guilty until he actually was found guilty. He never actually believed he was going to be found guilty. He's been lucky enough to been given the opportunity to have an appeal, but that's based on poor representation in his first trial. So they've allowed him to have another appeal, and he's going through collecting all his bits together now. I'm trying to help him out as much as I possibly can, and he's getting on it as much as he can. And since I've been in touch with him, I've had five more letters of people in prison who are also in the same situation that haven't done a murder, and it's just unbelievable, you know, unbelievable the stories that I'm being told and what people have gone through. And Over no evidence whatsoever, you know. It's just totally.
I received a phone call off a lady yesterday morning whose son has been recently been convicted to 18 years And she said even the judge said there was no evidence, no forensic evidence, no DNA, nothing to suggest that he was at the scene. But there was evidence to show that he may have been coming away from the scene after the murder had been committed. And she said someone came forward and went to the police to her son had been with him and that he hadn't committed any crime. And he was immediately arrested and charged with murder himself. And although the actual trial is over for her son and the convictions have already been done, this other person who wanted to be a witness for the original trial is now awaiting trial to stand alone for the same murder in September. And all he did was come forward and try to help and try to be a witness for the defence, so that he could help someone who he knew wasn't guilty of murder. But instead, he's now been charged with it and now faces a murder trial himself, knowing that, you know, his friend's been convicted. So it'll be easy for him to be convicted because the other boys have already been convicted and he's sort of been added to the list.
Wow. So even if you was with somebody and you can confirm that they didn't do a murder, you can then end up on a murder charge yourself. It's just unbelievable, isn't it? Just gets worse and worse and worse, really, this does. It's just, how can they do it? And then does anyone know? It's just terrible. I bet you must hear like loads of stories about all this. How many cases did you say you've got on there? 400? It must be growing all the time.
We've got just over 400 prisoners who have contacted us. And we think that's just the tip of the iceberg at the moment.
Yeah, it is definitely just the tip of the iceberg, I reckon. And these are often very big trials, aren't they, with a lot of people in the dock?
Yeah, there can be as many 20 defendants in the dock. And very often there won't be what that, you know, obviously instead of putting all 20 on in the dock, they'll have multiple trials. They'll start with 6 and then 5 and then 4 and they'll just go along until they've done them all. It's like a cattle market. Someone told me on, I think it was Wednesday last week, they went to the Old Bailey, and out of 18 trials that were going on in the Old Bailey on that day, 15 of them were all joint enterprise cases, and the QCs and barristers were running from one courtroom to another, doing multiple trials during the day.
Wow, that is a lot, isn't it? So it is definitely just the tip of the iceberg.
It's a frightening amount because it sort of it makes you think that, you know, when there's a murder, it doesn't happen. It's not every murder that happens in this country doesn't happen because 4 people have gone out and killed someone. You know, it just doesn't make sense. We've got more murderers than we have murders, and it doesn't make sense.
No, the number of people in prison has gone up dramatically, isn't it? And they are going to be building these super prisons now as well. And they need to fill the spaces, basically, don't they? And
Of course, the prisons have been privatised.
Yeah, once if they... Yeah, you're just cutting in and out there, Janet.
No.
But, yeah, I can hear you now, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're getting very similar to America because in America the prisons are privatised and that, you know, people have got really long life sentences and they're packed and they're like a business, and it's becoming the same in this country. We actually in England and Wales we actually have a higher the percentage of people doing life sentences in this country is 19% in comparison to 3% in the whole of Europe combined. So as a tiny island, we have a huge life of population, and the whole of Europe doesn't touch the amount that we have as a percentage in this country.
No, not at all. Did you want to say something, Sarah?
I'm just saying it's curious how similar this is to the way that people are railroaded in council tax cases. It's pretty much rubber stamp justice, isn't it? They've got a great long list. Yes, you're guilty, 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 guilty. No evidence, no nothing. that's it, off you go. And like you're saying, it's very clear that these are financially led cases. You're going into private prisons. The cases go on for ages and ages and ages. Barristers make a lot of money. Lawyers make a lot of money. Judges make a lot of money. And it's always been my observation that everyone who goes to appeal has been found guilty previously, presumably in magistrates' court. And the majority of those have been legally represented. And it always makes me question, why were they found guilty when someone like me, who's just a first-year law student, can take it to a High Court of Appeal and win those appeals? They're very simple to win quite often. There is no evidence, or the case is flawed, or the police broke the law. Yet, why did the duty solicitor allow them to be found guilty in the first place if they could have done what I did? So my question always is, follow the money. How much money does this actually
follow
make?
Money, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is people's lives at stake. I mean, murder, it's not just, you know, driving offense, murder. It's a serious thing. It destroys lives. It destroys families. I'm still gobsmacked by this, but I'm seeing how it's very similar to the way the other people have railroaded, particularly in the council tax cases.
Yeah, people are just railroaded through this and blindly, and their simple belief in the fact that they are innocent and the knowledge that they are innocent, I think, probably stops them working as hard as necessary as they should be. Really, I think. I think people just think it's not going to happen to them. And another thing we've been...
that the evidence that will be used in a trial process will be very strong evidence, because people think that, you know, with technology and the science and the forensic knowledge that we have now would be used, but very often it isn't. That type of evidence isn't there, and very often it isn't, because the police don't need to look for that evidence, because they can just use a principle, they can abuse the legal principle in order to get a conviction, rather than actually go out there and find hard evidence and forensic evidence, you know, and DNA, and use the technology to prove that someone's guilty. Rather than do that and spend money on that, they can use the joint enterprise principle very simply, because it works without the use of real evidence.
Yeah, that's just amazing, really. I think duty solicitors are probably employed, though, because they don't work on our side. They work more on the police's side. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what seems to be the case. Doesn't seem to be working for the people they're supposed to be representing. But somebody was saying, anyway, they've got to swear their loyalty to the bar, and to a few other things I can't remember exactly, but you're about fourth down on the list as their actual client, you know. They wanted, obviously, their loyalty, well, not obviously, but to their job. They don't want to lose their job. You know, all these things seem to sort of make, you know, have an effect on how well you are actually represented by a duty solicitor. I just urge anyone out there, whoever gets in trouble for anything, if you're innocent, do not get a duty solicitor. Did you find that most of the people who have been charged and convicted of joint enterprise, have they used duty solicitors then? Can you hear me, Janet?
Sorry, yes, I can now. It went really quiet for a second. Hello?
Hello, yeah, I was just asking if most of the people that have been convicted on this have probably used duty solicitors, haven't they?
I think what they do is, because they don't feel like they've got any reason not to, you know. I mean, most people, when they haven't committed any crime in the first place, don't have a solicitor. They don't have a family solicitor, they don't have a criminal solicitor, because they haven't committed any crimes previously. Some of the research that we've been doing with our cases, the cases that have come to us, quite a large amount of the people who are now in prison convicted of murder are actually first-time offenders, which to me sounds really, really bizarre, because, you know, your first offence doesn't, you know, it isn't going to be murder, is it? You know, it's really bizarre that, particularly when the people, you know, that we represent are being classed and vilified as gang members and, you know, hatchet men and gang leaders, but they have no criminal records, so there is no criminal association. So people like that don't, people who are like that don't have needed.
Yeah, my friend was judged because he's a New Age traveller. Well, all three of them were.
They won't feel there's any reason not to have the duty solicitor because they don't know any different.
No, you wouldn't, would you? But that Sarah was saying the loyalty to the crown first and then the bar, I think. I'm not quite sure about the order of all that. Go on then, Sarah, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I'm just researching as you're talking. It appears that there is an investigation going on by the House of Commons Justice Select Committee. Do you know how that's going, how that's progressing?
For joint enterprise, we're hoping to get another inquiry in there. I mean, we keep in touch with them, and we've done some research at the moment. We've had some university research with a lot of the cases that have come to us. And we're hoping to get that finalised soon and to present it to the Justice Select Committee. And hopefully, on the basis of the research that we've done, we'll get another inquiry. The first inquiry was just a brief inquiry. We want something bigger. We need them to push Parliament to do something now, because, you know, there clearly is a huge problem with the law, and there are too many people in prison, and it can't be ignored any longer. So hopefully we'll get another inquiry before the year's out, maybe, and be able to push it a little bit, you know, push it again like we did 2 years ago.
So it's not an ongoing thing then? They just sort of have a hearing and then they stop and go away and you have to chase them again?
Well, they release recommendations, and their recommendations are that, you know, that they wanted the law clearly set and clarifying in legislation, and the current government said that, you know, they didn't have enough money or resources, or, in my opinion, inclination to do that. They'd rather put people in prison at the cost of millions to the taxpayer than perhaps spend a quarter of that amount in a space of a year and clarify the law and put it in legislation. But we have constant contact with the Select Committee at the moment, and I think we're providing them with enough information and enough evidence for them to want to return to the subject and perhaps, you know, I don't know, maybe push this further so that something will be done in the next year or so.
Is there a named person responsible for this Select Committee, an MP or somebody?
We've got a number of MPs on board at the moment. Jeremy Corbyn's is really good. He keeps us, you know, he helped us to sort of get, you know, springboarded us, if you like, to actually realise that we could go to the Select Committee, the Justice Select Committee, and we could actually draft up our own submissions and put them forward. And we did that. And I think out of all the submissions that went through, the gender submission was one of them that was chosen to do, to take part in the oral hearing. So Jeremy Corbyn has been very good to us, you know, by advising us on how we ought to, you know, deal with the process and what we ought to do to, you know, to get the best outcomes.
Well, that's good to hear. Do you have legal advice? Do you have, you know, friends or? Do you have friendly barristers and legal advice that you can draw on as well? Did you hear that?
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
You must have a bad line there. I'm saying, do you have, or does Jennifer have, legal advice, friendly barristers, friendly lawyers that you can call?
We're in the process of gathering as many as we can. I mean, obviously, because of what's happened to us all, I mean, we've all been touched by it with a family member or a friend, so none of us have got an awful lot of trust in lawyers or barristers. And over the last 3 or 4 years, we've made contact with a few, and we have got, there are a few that we have on board at the moment who we do trust, who we do believe that they understand what's going on, and they're sort of voicing that they would like to help, And, you know, I think sometimes it's the barristers and the lawyers who have to gain our trust, because we've all been let down so badly. It's, you know, we were all promised in the first place that, you know, everything would be okay, and it wasn't. So the more trusting, the more intelligent and trusting ones that we can find, the better, because we do need good lawyers, and we, you know, but they're hard to come by sometimes.
Absolutely. But it must be a concern amongst the legal practitioners. There must be lawyers and barristers who realise what they're doing is just wrong, and it's constantly.
There are quite a few. I mean, we've got a few ombudsmen at the moment, and there are quite a few who, you know, they'll write pieces for the Guardian, and they'll write on the Justice Gap, and they'll actually talk about joint enterprise, which is something that, you know, no one was doing a couple of years ago. So I think we're sort of getting through to lawyers that this is, you know, it's the new like academics as well. I mean, quite a few of us do talks to universities, and because the academics and the lawyers are very interested in the subject, whether they're just interested in writing about it or whether they're interested because they want to do something about it, is perhaps another story. But I'd like to think they're interested because they want to help.
Consider contacting them and asking them to help.
Okay, we've got 4 minutes left.
And we've had a few. We've had legal meetings, but.
Okay, we haven't actually got very long left now. We've got four minutes left of the show.
On the same day at the same time seems to be the thing that we're struggling with, because obviously we're women up and down the country. You know, if we're going to all meet in London and we want all the lawyers to meet us in London, the hard bit is getting them all together on the same day when they're not actually committed to something else.
You never know if you ask. You know, there is Skype. People are very helpful if you're committed to a cause.
Yep, I think Janet's going to go on Skype, aren't you? So you can come and join us and be a bit clearer.
I'm going to have to. I'll definitely have to, because this is no good. I can't hear anything.
Funny, because Gloria was actually on, phoned in last week, and hers was quite clear. So it must just be the connection and the line. But actually, someone's just said get a new phone. Yeah, but we haven't got very long left. So is there anything, Janet or Sarah, that you'd like to say in the last few minutes?
I think if anyone's listening and they're interested, then obviously go onto the website. We've got a Facebook page as well. And, if you're interested, join us on the Facebook page. But most importantly, we've got a petition out there on the website, and we're looking for 10,000 signatures, and I don't think we've even reached 2,000 yet. So if anyone will be kind enough to sign it, then we'll know whether people or not.
Okay, what we'll do, we'll put it onto the website, and we've lost it now altogether. So, but we'll put it onto the website, and we'll also put the petition onto the Dark City page, because this is just unbelievable, and I think we all need to do something about this. This isn't something that we can just ignore. There's hundreds of people, literally hundreds and hundreds of people in prison for not actually doing anything, and that can't possibly be right in any way whatsoever. You know, it's not just my friend, there's loads of people's friends and family in there, and it's just unbelievable. Did you want to say anything else, Sarah, before we close up?
No, I was just saying before, but I don't think she heard me because the phone was packing up there. I think perhaps if they were much more proactive in getting hold of these friendly lawyers and getting their contacts and saying, look, can I just speak to you on the phone? Can you spare me some time? And also, if I can help in any way, I'm more than happy to do so. If you know, I'm happy to help.
That's absolutely brilliant. What I'll do is I'll get in touch with Janet again after the show and give her a ring and put you both in together. But please, everyone out there, please sign this petition. Go and look into this and go and see what the actual implications of this are and how easy it is for people to get put away just purely for association, and that association doesn't even have to be, walk in, even be there. You don't even have to be there. So we'll have more Jenga people on again soon, probably next week. I'm just going to arrange it and see what we can do, and let's see how we can push this forward and see how we can all get rid of this joint enterprise thing so that it's used in the proper way and not the way that it is being abused. Thank you, everyone, for joining in. Thank you very much, Janet. Thank you, Sarah, Jabba, Sparky and Bob. And thank you all to the listeners, and hopefully you'll listen again soon and we can all figure out how to get this stopped. Okay, thank you. Bye.
Good night.